Okay, it's time for our next speaker. Maryland is a very frustrating state to be a libertarian, and no question about it, but one of the good things are the people that live in our area, and we are fortunate to have, in my opinion, the best regional representative in the LNC, and that is Dr. Jim Lark. This is my fifth convention I've done. He has come up and joined us every time. He's always at our picnic. There's not another regional representative that will go out of their way. Heck, half the time, some of these people don't even return phone calls, much less go out of their way to attend our event. Dr. Jim Lark works at the University of Virginia. He's a professor, adjunct professor of systems engineering. He's a former chair of the National Party from 2000 to 2002. He is on his fourth term as a regional rep for the LNC. In 2008, he won the award, the LP's highest honor, the Thomas Jefferson Award, richly deserved, I might add. He also serves on the boards of the Advocates for Self-Government, the International Society for Individual Liberty, and the Students for Liberty. And he is here to tell us today about a problem many of us have, and that is knee-jerk libertarianism, a cure for the common disease. Please welcome Dr. Jim Lark.
Thank you very much. Whose device is this? Is this a recording device?
Yes, it is.
Okay, very nice. Well, you might not think it's very nice after I finish speaking. So I'd like to thank all of you. By the way, is my stentorian voice, is this sufficient?
Yeah.
You can all hear me? All right. You know, also, you won't consider it rude of me if I keep my coat unbuttoned? All right.
Absolutely.
All right. Yeah. That's right. I'd like to thank the Libertarian Party of Maryland for the invitation. I always look forward to coming up and seeing a lot of old friends, a lot of people who are doing great work for liberty. I'd like to apologize to my friend Ken Krawchuk. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to get here to hear his speech. I was delayed a little bit, so my apologies. I hope to be here for your speech. This afternoon, I'd like to give an address entitled Knee-Jerk Libertarianism, A Cure for a Common Disease. And before I launch into my address, I first gave this talk at the Libertarian Party of Mississippi Convention in January of 1998. And I was afraid when I gave this talk that I was going to be stoned, not in the sense of inebriated, but in the sense of lapidated. You know, you talking about me? You must be talking about me. And it turned out everyone seemed to like the talk, and people would come up and say, Jim, that knee-jerk libertarianism stuff, I know, you're absolutely right, and I know just what you're talking about. You're talking about him, aren't you? I suspect all of us who've been in the liberty game, who've been trying to go out and promote the ideas of a liberty and personal responsibility, we've all come across that phenomenon when we're trying to explain our ideas to someone, and that someone will say, well, you libertarians, you don't care about the poor, or you don't care about national defense, or you're a bunch of capitalist pigs who hate the poor, or you're a bunch of bleeding heart liberal commie pinkos. You have heard that, haven't you? Okay. And if you're like me, you're probably thinking, my goodness, what a knee-jerk response. That's not at all what I'm talking about. Well, unfortunately, just as with conservatives, liberals, socialists, communists, what have you, libertarians are perfectly capable of engaging in knee-jerk responses. And it's no better when we do it than when those with whom we disagree do it. We don't like it when we're faced with knee-jerk arguments, or knee-jerk responses, not so much arguments, but responses. And it's no better when we do it. And as a matter of fact, we got to do it better and cleaner because, frankly, for the time being, there are fewer of us, at least fewer self-identified libertarians. So what I'd like to do today is to give you sort of Lark's little taxonomy of types of knee-jerk libertarianism, and then suggest some ways in which we might be able to do a better job of explaining and promoting our ideas. And I'll try to leave plenty of time for questions. First of all, let me define what I mean by knee-jerk libertarianism. I'll give you a working definition. It's what I will call an ill-considered response to status stimuli. Now, the response may be, in some ways, perfectly correct, but it's inappropriate in some way. It doesn't really deal with what the person is when you're responding. It doesn't really deal with the subject. And so, what are some types of knee-jerk libertarian responses? Well, the first one I'll call the free market will take care of it response. How many of you know how many libertarians it takes to change a light bulb?
The market will do it.
None. The market will do it. Now, it very well may be the market will do it. However, there are many problems in our society where it is by no means obvious that a market orientation, market order, liberal, truly liberal order, will actually address some of these serious problems. And I refer principally to environmental problems. Okay? Consider the issue of whether we have anthropogenerated global warming. That's the fancy way of saying, is human activity contributing to some sort of climate change? Are we forcing changes in our climate? Now, I tend to be rather like Pat Michaels. I tend to be, he referred to as, was it flatliners, hotheads, and the lukewarm. I guess I'm lukewarm. I would not be at all surprised to find that human activity is contributing to some sort of increase in mean temperature. I don't know. I'm not a specialist in that area, and because I was once studied physics, that does not mean that I'm qualified to address the science of the air. There are a lot of, by the way, a lot of physicists who think because they, you know, it's like Mr. Science, I have a degree in science, and therefore they can address very sophisticated questions in climatology. I don't know whether there is man-made global warming, and even if there is man-made global warming, I'm not at all convinced that any sort of government proposals that have been put forth that would, you know, would basically change the way we live our lives, I'm not at all convinced that any of these things would do anything to stop whatever problems are occurring. If we actually are causing problems to the environment, then I think we need to address them, because if we are engaging in forms of pollution, if you will, that are causing some sort of harm, we may, by the way, be faced with a situation where particular actions, none of which would be considered rights violative. In other words, if I'm the only guy with an internal combustion engine, and it's not a really big one, it's not very loud, if I crank it up, the effluent that comes out, I'm not sure too many people would really get upset about it. It's not clear that people would say, yes, you're engaging in tortuous activity. If we have literally billions of people with billions of internal combustion engines, it very well may be that the aggregate of these actions actually does cause harm. And it's not immediately obvious to me that a, quote, libertarian solution will solve the problem. It should be noted, it's not clear to me that any solution is necessarily going to solve the problem. And I certainly have no confidence that government will do a better job than efforts to use market mechanisms. However, if we airily dismiss concerns of people by saying, well, first of all, it isn't a problem, well, I'm not sure that that's the case. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Or if we say just the market will take care of it, I'm not sure that we're really being, first of all, we're being correct, because it's not at all obvious to me the market will take care of it. Again, I'm not sure government will do a better job. But we have to be willing to address concerns, and we have to be willing to acknowledge that perhaps markets are not going to work perfectly. Again, we should also be very careful to make sure the question is properly framed, and that is government going to do a better job? And in many cases, I think the answer is no. In fact, I dare say in most cases the answer is no. I'm almost ready to say in all cases the answer is no, but I won't go quite that far because I don't think that, I'm not sure that that's correct. Another type of knee-jerk behavior is what I call the government employees are evil, lazy, venal, status scum argument. When I was growing up, the nicest people you'd find in my hometown of Pulaski, Virginia, were the people who work for the post office. They're extremely nice people. They go out of their way to do nice things for you. I went to government schools all the way through. I'm a Virginia Tech alumnus. Go Hokies. Hopefully Virginia Tech will win a big basketball game against Duke this afternoon. My teachers, when I went to government schools in Pulaski County, Virginia, my teachers were good people. They cared about the education of the students. They wanted to see us get a good education. Now, looking back on things, I think they were wrong in terms of how do we best deliver this product we call education to people. I think basically the state should get completely out of the business of providing education. But it's not because these people were bad or stupid or lazy. Okay? In many cases, government employees are actually very good people who the reason they get involved in government service is because they want to help people. They're good folks. A little story. I did not observe this, but a good friend of mine related to me, and I have no doubt it's true. I'll just refer to this person as a candidate at the national level. Gave a speech in Virginia, where it was a campaign speech, and this person used a joke that said basically referring to people in the United States military as being nothing more than postal employees in khaki or in Navy. And it was meant to be funny. But there was, I understand, a captain in the United States Army who was present, who was insulted by the comment and basically left. Didn't spend the time to learn more about the libertarian perspective. Now again, there are plenty of times when I look at government employees as being evil or stupid or lazy, because they are evil or stupid or lazy. But to engage in generalizations is, first of all, it's just not a good idea. And in many cases, we may fail to reach out to people who are perhaps in the best position to assess the problems of overly large, overly intrusive, overly expensive government. They may know where the bodies are buried, in some cases, literally. And we don't want to turn them off just for the heck of it. We should treat them with courtesy and respect. By the way, in the interest of full disclosure, University of Virginia is a state institution, so I do receive a paycheck from government. Unlike everyone else who has no involvement whatsoever with government in any way. There's another type of knee-jerk behavior which I refer to as the often wrong but never in doubt type of knee-jerk. And I attribute that phrase to the eminent moral philosopher and basketball commentator Billy Packer, who used to, as a matter of self-deprecating humor, he would offer an opinion, and he would say, often wrong but never in doubt, referring to his own position. And I've encountered this on many occasions when libertarians will assert that markets will work in some fashion or that markets are superior to some form of collective action without necessarily having any real evidence to support it. Now, one of my interesting eccentricities, I'm a man of many eccentricities, a man of many failings and few virtues, but one of the things I do consider a virtue is I tend to be data-driven. In other words, you show me the facts, you show me that I'm wrong, and you will see me turn immediately. Because to me, one of the worst things to do is to wallow in ignorance or in error. I owe it to the people with whom I'm dealing to try to be scrupulously honest, scrupulously fair, to try to follow the facts wherever they lead. And I've seen many libertarians who basically will get up and they will make a case, often wrong but never doubt. There was a fairly prominent libertarian, I will not mention the name, who gave a speech at the University of Virginia. And it was a he, which is so unusual, I mean, given the female orientation of the Libertarian Party. So I realize I may be revealing too much by saying it was a he, but he made a comment. He was talking about some environmental matter, and he was referring to a book that had come out and had criticized the United States Department of the Interior. He was making a point about how the Department of the Interior was screwing things up in terms of land management in the United States. And he said he hadn't read the book, but he was sure that it made the case that government was screwing things up, which struck me as rather odd. I'm one of these people, I prefer to read the book before I will actually pass judgment as to whether it's a good book, it makes a good case. So we have to be careful that we don't get into this habit of often wrong, but never in doubt. Another type of knee-jerk behavior may be the no soft landing type. And I will illustrate this by, there was a radio interview in which a candidate for office, a libertarian candidate for office, was asked by a talk show host, "You mean you libertarians would legalize marijuana and heroin and cocaine?" With an air of incredulity, you know, how can you possibly think this? Now, before I give you this candidate's response, let me suggest that there are many ways in which one might respond to this in a way that might engage this person. First of all, we might use what is referred to as the Ransberger pivot. Some of you may be familiar with that rhetorical technique, where we find what is motivating the concern behind the question. We identify that concern to the extent we share that concern, which is usually the case. We don't want to see drug-crazed fiends running around. We don't want to see pushers trying to hook little kids on dope. So we understand the concern that's being embraced and show, you know, how a truly libertarian society would be able to address these problems. And I would suggest, by the way, with respect to ending drug prohibition, the only way we can deal with the problems of drug abuse is to end drug prohibition. And we can go into that in the question period. But there are many ways in which one might have been able to find what's motivating the question. And then we show how a libertarian way, at the very least, might deal with some of these problems. Now, we wouldn't necessarily expect the person to immediately jump in and agree, but we could at least give this person a soft landing. So how did this candidate respond when asked with an air of incredulity? You mean you libertarians would legalize marijuana and heroin and cocaine? The response, let me see if I can get this right. Yep. Now again, in some ways a perfectly valid response, but I'm not sure it really did the job in terms of... Yes, okay. Another type of knee-jerk behavior is the what you say may not be what they hear type of knee-jerk behavior. The Food and Drug Administration is a big issue with me. The fact that the FDA has police powers over what you put in your body for your health, safety, or comfort. Now, I'm in the fortunate position. God looks after fools and Englishmen. I'm not English. By the grace of God, I've always been reasonably healthy. I've never had any serious illnesses. No one in my family, the Lark family and the Owen family, we've always been remarkably fortunate. We seem to live to very long, very long lives, very old ages. We don't seem to get involved in accidents that kill us at an early age. So we've been very, very fortunate. But there are plenty of people who cannot obtain the substances that might prolong their life or at least give them some hope because the FDA has police powers. Okay? So when I talk about ending the police powers of the Food and Drug Administration, I talk about the issues about how we might promote lower costs, diversity, hope. And that's what libertarians are likely to hear. When I talk about ending the police powers or perhaps even, shall we say, abolish the FDA, you're probably thinking more drugs, lower prices, more diversity of treatment, hope for people who are heretofore hopeless or have no hope. Other people might hear botulism, tainted meat, thalidomide. Okay? So when we go out to explain our ideas, we have to realize what we say may not be what we hear. Many of us, when we actually have the opportunity to talk about matters of policy or politics, we are frequently talking to fellow libertarians. You all may know where I'm coming from, to use that phrase. When we go out to the general public, they may not know where we're coming from. They haven't had the time to think through a lot of the things that we may take for granted. And I'll come back to that point in a few moments. So, if you're going to be an effective advocate for liberty, you have to realize to whom are you speaking and what are the goals? Why are you talking to these people? What do you hope to accomplish? If you are trying to scare the pants off of them, well, you can do that in a variety of ways, and some libertarians are very good at it. If you're trying to get them to understand how a society based on liberty and personal responsibility might be able to deal better with the problems of the human condition, then maybe you take the time, you invest the time, to learn how to address those concerns. A final type of knee-jerkism that I will address is the... I didn't come up with a catchy way of encapsulating. I'll just call it the failure to perceive how our fellow citizens view the government. Any Monty Python enthusiasts in here?
Oh, yeah.
I knew I was with a hip crowd. Some of you may know the film Life of Brian. There's a scene where the People's Front of Judea, they're having a discussion. Judean People's Front of Judea. Where they're trying to push the Romans out of Palestine. And John Cleese, who I think is a comedic genius, he's playing Reg, the leader of the People's Front of Judea, and he's talking about, referring to the Romans, they've led us what? And what have the Romans ever done for us? And this little guy at the back of him says, the aqueduct? Yeah, aqueduct. And this sets off this cavalcade of all the things the Romans have actually done for the people of Judea. And I mention this, one, because I think it's funny, and two, because when we talk about government programs, in many cases we focus upon what government shouldn't be doing at all. We see waste, we see fraud, we see abuse, we see stuff government just has no business doing, either by virtue of constitutional provision or simply it's just not their damn right to do it. Our friends and neighbors, they may see benefits. We see costs, we see problems, they see benefits. So if we're going to try to engage them, if we're going to try to help show them how a libertarian society will be a better society, we need to understand that what we see as problems, costs, waste, they may actually see as benefits. So we have to do a better job of trying to figure out how do we explain and promote these ideas. Now, a few points to help us perhaps get past this knee-jerkism. One thing that, again, we need to do, if we're going to be effective advocates for liberty, we need to take the time to learn our craft. We have to prepare. Any of you know who Bobby Knight is, the former basketball coach at Indiana University and then Texas Tech? There's a wonderful phrase that Coach Knight used. People talk about the will to win. Do you have the will to win? He said, heck, everybody... Well, he didn't say heck. That wasn't the four-letter word he used. He said, everybody's got the will to win. Do you have the will to prepare? Do you have the will to do the hard work that is necessary if you're going to be an effective advocate for liberty? And it is hard work. It takes time and trouble to learn to prepare. This, by the way, Ken Krawchuk has for many years talked about how do we become better advocates for liberty? How do we learn our craft? Well, it takes time. It takes effort. I'm fortunate. I get paid to flap my gums. I'm a university professor and thus don't have to work for a living, so I get plenty of practice flapping my gums. And I have to entertain people. I mean, the students, you know, it's a rough crowd, let me tell you. Actually, Mr. Gastignaga asked the question, do I get any respect since I have power over their lives? Yes, I do. So we need to be willing to take the time and trouble to prepare. We also need to think, when we engage people, we need to economize on resources. There are some times where I will engage someone, and it's clear that person, his mind ain't right. He's not really ready to engage libertarian ideas. Okay? There are some people who are never going to be willing to engage libertarian ideas, and it's really not a good use of your time and resources to try to argue with people. Also, let us say that you're doing outreach, say at a booth. Someone wants to come by and have an argument with you. You know, you have to understand, who's your audience here? Are you trying to argue with this person? If there are a lot of people around, I'm not sure that those are the people, you know, that this guy's what you want to reach. You want to talk to the other people. So you need to be willing to say, you know, sometimes I'm just not going to engage someone in an argument because it's not really a situation where I can win. Maybe you step back and you say, or you pull the person aside, let's have a nice quiet chat. By the way, it's never a bad idea to ask questions, polite questions. Let the other person do the talking in many cases. Let him talk his, let him show you where his concerns are. One of the biggest things that I think libertarians fail to realize is, how do we win victories? Revolutions of the sort that we're fighting in many cases proceed inch by painful inch. And in many cases, the biggest victories you will win are by helping people to see that the areas of disagreement are not nearly so great as they might have thought. If you, by virtue of listening to people, entertaining their questions with courtesy and respect, if you can simply clear away the misconceptions that many people... How many cases do we know of people who they thought, oh, you libertarians believe this? No, we don't. Oh, you libertarians want this? No, we don't. You libertarians don't want these good things, but yes, we do want good things for our friends and neighbors. We want to live in a better world. We want to live in a world of peace and harmony, where people are free to live their lives the way they see fit as long as they don't violate the like rights of their neighbors. And if you have the opportunity to explain this with courtesy, with respect, I think you'd be amazed. Well, no, this is a hip crowd, so you wouldn't be amazed. Some libertarians would be amazed at the extent... I got a big shovel up here. You might be pleased to see the extent to which you can simply clear away the misconceptions. And if all you ever do when you engage people in explaining our ideas is you clear away the misconceptions so they know where the real disagreements are, look how far you've moved the ball down the field. Look how far you've moved down the field. In revolutions of our sort, you don't have to get people You don't have to get everyone to come over and agree with us. In many cases, all you have to do is get them to the point where they don't feel they have to oppose you. They don't have to work it. You know, those libertarians, I don't agree with them on some points, but the world's not going to hell if they are given positions of responsibility. Look how far you've moved the ball down the field to help us move toward a society of liberty and responsibility. A couple of final points, and then I'm going to open up for questions. Understand that many of the most important points that you may make to open people's eyes have nothing to do with being a libertarian. The idea, for example, that minimum wage laws hurt the very people whom they're putatively intended to help, that's just a matter of economics. If you understand price theory, you understand that. You don't have to be a libertarian to embrace that. The idea that ending drug prohibition is going to make it a lot better in terms of our ability to deal with problems of drug abuse, that has nothing to do with being a libertarian. That's just good public policy. The idea that giving the FDA police powers to regulate what you put in your body for your health, safety, or comfort, that may end up killing more people than it helps. That's just a matter of science. You just tot up, well, unfortunately it's a little hard to tot up the corpses, but that in some ways you could, there's evidence to show. You don't have to be a libertarian to embrace that. So don't feel, one of the things about people that I've noticed is sometimes they feel, in order for me to embrace libertarian ideas, I have to be a libertarian. I don't care whether you call yourself a libertarian if you embrace our ideas. If you understand important principles, you don't have to buy the whole farm. And I think I have a friend, let me digress very briefly. I have a friend, some of you may know this, but great guy, good friend of mine, who he has this charming habit of greeting people who are new to libertarian meetings, welcoming them in, and he'll chat with them, and he'll inevitably find that one point that they don't agree with what he feels is the libertarian perspective, and he will very politely, very graciously try to show them where they're wrong. Even if it takes the rest of his life, he'll because you can't be 99.44% pure. You got to be 100%. And he's a very nice guy. I consider him a good friend. You don't have to get people to buy the whole farm. If you just get people on one issue, look how much progress you're making. Somebody comes up to me, Lark, you son of a bitch. Maybe we agree on 10%. Okay, let's work on the 10%. There'll be plenty of time for arguing later. If we agree on 10%, if we agree on ending drug prohibition, or we agree on getting the United States government from going around serving as the world's police, well, whatever. If that's the one issue, let's work together. I'm not going to compromise my principles. I'm not going to soft soap my principles. But let's agree to disagree. Okay. Another point, and I don't think we libertarians do this enough. Whenever we're discussing issues of public policy, I think we need to make sure that those people with whom we're discussing, if we get to the point where we can actually carry on a proper discussion, we need to point out that in a free society, the default value is freedom. Because of this, the burden of proof should never be upon us to argue in favor of freedom. If someone is proposing that we use the coercive apparatus of the state, and they usually don't put it in those terms, but that's what they're doing, we should point out, excuse me, burden of proof is not on me. Those who would use the power of government, isn't the burden on them in a free society? Shouldn't the burden be on them? I submit the answer is yes. So, with that, I'll open it up to questions, comments, arguments. Hey, you have the lovely lady in the back.
I'm only bringing this up because I think you can use this in future speeches, but in my campaign for governor, I have a terrific example of people not hearing what the same thing that you're hearing about me. And to my deep regret, I didn't get this insight until about the Thursday before the election. And at the beginning, I could have done something with it more than I did. But at the beginning of the campaign, I went to a lot of the Tea Party meetings, and Campaign for Liberty, Americans for Prosperity, and yada yada. And every time you hear people say, you gotta rise up as citizens and take back our government, this is in the context of the Patriot Act, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, all the several trillion dollar debt, and all these other things like that. And I think, we gotta take back our government. It's what our government, not these politicians, the government, not Rupert, and so on. anyway, so I went to this get out the vote rally at a mostly black church. Again, it was a Thursday before election. I heard Elijah Cummings, one of our congressmen, speak, and I saw suddenly I saw how that sounds to an African American. He said, because, you know, this is a huge mistake that the Tea Party people made in Maryland. I don't know about other states, but they were always linking it with anti-Obama. You know, and he wasn't even running. You know, this just made no sense. But anyway, so, Cummings said something like, they want to take back our government. The moment we get an African American, beautiful African American family in office, you know, Barack and Michelle and Sasha and Malia, this beautiful family, there are people now that are in the presidency, and now they're rising up and they want to take back our government. Their government? Who said this? Their government. You know, it was like that. And I just realized, you know, how it sounded to other people. And I didn't sound close by way to me at all. So, you know, and I really think that I was able to get a lot of African American people, because I know a lot of them, to vote for me, you know. But I could have gotten so many more if I'd understood this earlier on and been able to say, you know, point out every time I was out in public, point out Obama's not running. This is a race for governor. If you love Obama, you can still vote for me. You know, support Obama all you want, but vote for me.
This gentleman, yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jim, I guess I have no problem with what you're saying, but again, I know I've had a conversation in the past. It's still going to be, what is going to get someone to vote for you? You know, so what's this for me syndrome that, you know, we almost have to think, what are the three biggest reasons you vote for a libertarian when you say we're going to get the economy back on track? Then again, that's how are you going to? Are you really going to tell people, well, here, we're going to cut benefits? You know, if you're Social Security, sure. Are we going to cut Medicare, Medicaid, you know, 35% so that we can at least start getting them fiscally sound? And, you know, a lot of times they're just not things that people are going
sure.
to...
Well, I mean, that's it's an excellent question, and of course, there is something of a difference between when you're in campaign mode and when you're having a polite discussion with coworkers, with family members, with loved ones. The short answer is, I don't know. The longer, more nuanced answer is, I don't know, but I have some ideas. I think what you do is you try, first of all, to listen to what they're saying, and you try to identify what their principal concerns are. And then, to the extent that there's a libertarian way of addressing them, you address where they, you know, you go after what interests them most. You try to find out what are the major concerns for them, and it's not so much that you soft settle, you know, soft pedal everything else. You just simply look for what interests them the most. Let them tell you what they're interested in, and then show how a libertarian society may be able to address their concerns.
Because I might add, just thinking about marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. He can say, well, I'll vote legalize smoking. I don't think you can throw that many votes because it's not the number one issue for so many people.
Sure.
So what, you can smoke marijuana if you don't have a job or, you know, you're
violent
from the street,
you know, you're something that won't help you out. By the way, allow me to come back to a point. And one thing that it took a while for me to realize this. Any of you musicians? I'm a very bad one. I was the concert master of my hometown orchestra. You've heard of the blind leading the blind. This was the deaf leading the deaf. The old joke about my dad compared me to Yasha Heifetz, the Heifetz the ain't. There are certain things I can do with the violin, or playing drums, or playing. I can do these things now without thinking about them. I mean, when I first started playing the drums, I mean, it was really hard to keep the backbeat on the two and the four. Now I can sit down, I can actually play with good musicians, and I can keep a decent backbeat in 4-4 time. There are things I can do now, I don't have to think about it, because I've been doing it for a long time. There are ideas that we sometimes fail to say, how could anyone not understand this? It's so simple. Well, it's simple because we've thought about it a lot. We've looked into the issues. For us, it's become almost second nature. And sometimes it's difficult. Like Dean Armand and I were just chatting a few moments ago about professorial type stuff, the leisure of the theory class, we like to say. And I stole that from a line from Arnie Brightman. Sometimes it's hard to remember how difficult was this to learn this point when we had to go through it. When I first heard about the libertarian perspective in a coherent fashion, it was actually the day before the 1976 presidential election. My professor of electricity and magnetism decided we wouldn't talk about electricity and magnetism. We talked about the proper relationship between the individual and the state. And he did a good job of it. I heard this libertarianism stuff, and I rather liked it in the sense that I didn't want to use a big stick of the state to hit my neighbors over the head to get them to live their lives the way I thought they should. But I had real questions on prudential grounds. Would a libertarian society be a good society? It might be a just society. Would it be a good society? Would it be the sort of society I want to live in? Because I don't want to see little old ladies who've lost their husbands, they have no means of support. I don't want to see them kicked out in the street. I don't want to see some poor slob who, you know, he's tried to live his life the right way. He doesn't have money for health care. I don't want to see him go without health care. I want a good society where people care about their neighbors because it's the right thing to do, not because government's pointing a gun at them. We should care about it because it's the right thing to do. There are certain things that I want to see a good society, and I wondered, would a society based on libertarian principles, would it be a good society? Well, it took me a while thinking through this stuff. And I like to flatter myself to see that I'm a reasonably bright boy. Whether it's true or not, it's a pleasant conceit. It took me a while to think this stuff through. It's not fair for me to present these ideas, some of which, by the way, the policy implications of which are counterintuitive, highly counterintuitive. In drug prohibition, you reduce the problems of drug abuse. That's counterintuitive. It took me a while to think that through. It's not fair. When we present our ideas to people, it's not fair to assume or to think that they should immediately embrace them, because we probably didn't. And so what we have to do, we have to try to facilitate conditions by which people convince themselves. I don't convince anybody of anything. I facilitate conditions by which people convince themselves. I dare say most of you have probably not had the phenomenon occur where somebody comes up and says, you know, I want to thank you because by virtue of your brilliance, you crushed me into dust. I had these statist ideas, and you were able to humiliate me in such a way that I felt lower than whale poop, and I immediately then wanted to go out and embrace these libertarian principles because you so thoroughly humiliated me. You ground me into a little pile of dust, and I can't thank you enough. I try to help people understand ideas because, again, it's after a fashion. I had my evangelical. Well, I'm still an evangelical, but I had a sort of really evangelical period, and then I backed off a little bit because I realized it's just not fair for us to assume that people will take these ideas and immediately agree with them. I didn't immediately agree with them. Let's see. There was a question here, a question over here. I actually spawned a lot of questions. Question?
I just want to comment on what you said about the importance of listening to people.
What did you say? Somebody needs to have a snare drum up here.
Alex is running mate for lieutenant governor, and so she and I went all over the state, and one of our biggest issues was get rid of all the useless and harmful regulations that we can on business. So, what impressed me about Susan was that every time she would meet a small businessman, she would ask them, what are the regulations that are causing you the most trouble? And then she would ask that, and she'd do an amazing thing, was she would listen to what they said. And I could see it in people's faces. It's like, and they would talk. And you could see in their faces, it's like, somebody is finally listening to me. And I saw it myself. I answered all the questions we got about what's your position on this or that from our website. And I got a question from a said, well, I'm a teacher, and what's your position on public education? And so he and I exchanged, so I told him, and we exchanged three or four emails. And finally he ended up saying, he said, well, I don't really agree with you, but I may vote for you anyway. just because you're the only one who would listen to me.
Wonderful. There was a question over here, then Mr. Gastagnaglia, then this gentleman, then Dr. Ava. Yes. Question? Yes.
A couple questions. One, talking about the free market. We've never had a free market. We're not likely to ever get a free market. The freest market in the world is Hong Kong, and that's still got some regulation. When you read Welcome Nation, which I didn't read in my late 60s, you're amazed at how Adam Smith is ranting against the mercantilist and all the other fixer class, which is what you have. When you go into politics, and I deal with them, I was justified three times this past week, and I'm dealing with them every day, they all have their little issues that they're going to fix and take care of, and they all got their paybacks and so forth. So that's the first thing that I think libertarians need to understand when they talk about this miraculous, free market. The other thing is you made a statement that markets might not work perfectly. Nothing works perfectly, period. And so, they work pretty efficiently at taking your liberty. In my lifetime, they've taken the vast majority of it. But they're one of the best examples of what the FDA did. They stopped a beta blocker, which has been used in Europe for years, and they blocked it for 5 years, and it's estimated pretty accurately that 50,000 people were saved every year. So in 5 years, down 50,000, they killed 250,000 people. So if you can say that you killed 250,000 people, that's direct. But let's look at the cost factor. There was just in economics update. There was a medicine that women were taking, pregnant women, when they had these problems with carrying their birth. And they've now, the FDA has given a patent to the company, and it was costing $10 a shot, and it's now $1,500. So the FDA has allowed them, because of the patent process, to charge $1,500, which immediately means that there's a lot of women going to lose their fetuses or die, thanks to government.
What can I say to that? Sir, you had a comment or question?
A comment. I think both your talk and Ken's talk really dovetail very well. And it has to do with a simple thing. When we are addressing the public, we're not talking to ourselves while we look at ourselves in the mirror. And I've seen this over and over again. We have a duty, and I would even borrow from the founding fathers, sacred duty, to make sure that we get our message across clearly. And we have to really do it. I may not agree necessarily with Ken's solution to the problem, but I definitely agree with his approach. And I think most of us. We need to realize that we're not talking to ourselves. By the time I was in my late teens and early 20s, I was really alone to the libertarian part of that. And I sidetracked myself. I started listening to all the other baloney, playing on the heartstrings of my anti-communist experience. I had to fight and I got totally digressed. It wasn't until my late 30s that I began to get back on track. But it took me a long time, just like you said, it took me a long time to get, how can I walk up to just somebody in the street, and like you said, pulverize them and expect them to pay. And I think that you're both absolutely correct.
Thank you. Thank you. By the way, Marshall Fritz, the late Marshall Fritz, had this wonderful phrase. There's a certain type of evangelical libertarianism. And by the way, being a Christian and coming out of the tradition of the Methodist Church, which was not extremely evangelical, but did have its sort of outreach efforts. I mean, in the libertarian movement, we have our regular Sunday school teachers, our regular ministers to minister to the flock. We have our missionaries. I consider myself a missionary. We have our revivalists. And they all have their place. But Marshall Fritz had this wonderful phrase about certain evangelicals. I said, I've been screwed up for 40 years, but now I understand libertarianism. I can straighten you out in 15 minutes. Maybe you can, but I wouldn't take good odds on that. Sir, you had a comment.
The current incarnation of America is going to follow the choices of fear and the unpleasant people. I wonder if you do agree with that, if you you have any ideas of what sort of arbitrage we could articulate to the more advanced to make us prescient?
Well, there's an old expression about forecasting is difficult, particularly when it concerns the future. My crystal ball broke a long time ago. I tend to think that we're not going to see some sort of revolutionary upheaval or cataclysm. Why? Because revolutions are expensive. It takes a lot to get people to go out. I mean, most people, particularly our society, is incredibly wealthy. This is an incredibly wealthy society by world standards. Revolutions, you really got to push people a long way to get them to get up and actually risk what their life, liberty, and property. So I don't see, I should sound like Lennon here, not John Lennon, the other Lennon. I don't know that the revolutionary conditions are in place for any sort of upheaval right now. Now, contrary to rumor, I have been wrong before. And for example, I didn't see the Berlin Wall falling when it did. There were people who did. I didn't. So whatever I say, take it with the appropriate size grain of salt. With respect to harbingers, well, if you see all the ammunition disappearing off the, if you can't buy any ammo, and it's not because the government's confiscated, it's just all gone, and you find that there are barricades popping up, you can't drive certain places, that's probably a harbinger. Anything more subtle than that, I'm not sure that I will see it. I think that we are getting to a point, though, where people, in many cases, it's finally starting to hurt overly large, overly expensive, overly intrusive government. We're now getting to the point where darn near everybody is feeling some real pain. We may, however, an interesting point, Jim Buchanan, the 1986 Nobel laureate in economics, the last address he gave when the Public Choice Center was at Virginia Tech. I was a visiting scholar, visiting schmuck at the time, and so I listened to his address. He talked about Social Security, and he said we might actually be reaching a point with respect to Social Security, which really is the linchpin of the welfare state in this country, that everyone may know the system is going to go bust. Everyone knows the system is ultimately going to collapse. But you would never be able to put together a large enough coalition to make the changes, because there will always be a sufficiently large cohort that will lose enough that they will oppose the change. And I don't know whether he's right or not, but it's certainly something that is, it's certainly something to think about. And by the way, there was a phrase in Poland before communism completely collapsed. Well, it didn't completely collapse, before it mostly collapsed in Poland. And it translates into English, situation fatal but not serious. And as best as I can understand, it means we all know we're going to die, but it's sufficiently off in the future that it's not, in other words, it's not serious because it's not right there in our face. Social Security is going to collapse, but it's sufficiently far out there that for various reasons we may not want to take the time and trouble to fight it now, mañana, tomorrow. So we're facing a lot of very interesting questions. I actually had the chance to be interviewed on the radio this past Wednesday. The talk show host was talking about Social Security and about what we do, and somebody's going to have to take a haircut, pretty sizable haircut. I mean, somebody is going to get hurt. No matter what happens, somebody's going to get stuck with a big part of the check. And other people, they may be looking forward to certain benefits. They're not going to be there. This is one of the biggest problems of overly large, overly intrusive, overly expensive government, is it manages to change what ought to be positive sum games into negative sum games, where somebody is going to lose. Perhaps we're all going to lose. So, let's see. Dr. Armand.
I really appreciate your thoughts, and I'm perhaps at least, if not more, susceptible to all of these problems that you identified in vulnerability. So, therefore, I thought I might give others the benefit of my own personal struggle against them.
Please.
I'll help with one of them, and that is the the issue that you can't convert, you can't convince somebody in 15 minutes after they've been inundated in a lifetime of propaganda in a particular point of view. And this is, I have this experience not only with libertarianism, but as you know, a couple of decades ago, you invited me to the University
yes.
of Virginia to talk about the Palestinians.
Yes, yes.
So I've had that similar situation. And of course, now, with the anti-Muslim propaganda, I'm dealing with that too. But in all three cases, what I found is that it helps to take an attitude. I'm not trying to convince somebody in 15 minutes. I'm trying to convince people.
Exactly.
And if I can get people to give me something to think about,
exactly.
that will prompt them to say, I got to look up some more about this. Maybe I don't know everything about this subject, and maybe there's something I've overlooked. That is, I think it's pretty effective, relatively effective, certainly more effective than trying to convince somebody in 15 minutes. And it's also better
than
my own emotional state.
Well, by the way, allow me, I don't know if I've ever done this publicly, allow me to thank you for all the good work that you've done in so many areas. I still do a lot of outreach. I mean, I staff tables at gun shows, at student activity fairs, I mean, pretty much anywhere where somebody... Pardon?
Beer
festivals. Absolutely. I'm at my peak when I'm in the libation party. Drinks for everyone. Well, in that case, everybody's going to need a drink. That's one of those delayed reaction jokes that'll go off in a few minutes. When I do outreach, this may sound a little odd, but my immediate goal is not to convince people of libertarianism. My immediate goal is to get that person with whom I'm talking to, you know that Jim Lark guy? Pretty nice guy. And I enjoy talking to him. And I like to talk to him. I don't care what his ideological position is. He's a nice guy. And I'd like to talk to that guy about music or sports or all sorts of stuff because he's a nice guy. Once people make the identification with you as a human being with whom they have something in common, they're probably going to be much more inclined to listen to what you have to say. And they may not agree with it, but it's not fair for us to insist that they agree with us. You know, if we just make a connection, there's a wonderful phrase that, you know, Tip O'Neill was wrong. It's not all politics is local. All politics is personal. People got to know you, trust you, and like you. If you get to the point where you're able to deal with people, and people say, you know what, I'll tell you what, that Bob Johnson, I don't agree with him, but he's a good guy. He's the kind of guy I could trust with my wallet. I could trust that he's not going to send my kids to go off and die in some meat grinder overseas. I can trust him. He's a good man. He's whatever he does in a position of responsibility, he's going to do it for what he thinks is right. Again, look how far you have gone moving the ball down the field. If people identify, oh, those libertarians, they're those nice people, like Doc Ahmad. He's a good guy. He's a man of his word. I could trust him. I may not agree with him. Heck, I don't agree with me on everything. I look in the mirror. I don't agree with me on everything. If you get people to think, oh, those libertarians, those are those nice people who are good neighbors. They're people of their word. They're not going to dump trash on my property. They're not going to steal my wallet. They're not going to steal money out of my wallet. Again, look how far you've gone down the line in terms of helping people to think, oh, a libertarian society, maybe not so bad. Are we on time? Are we out of time? I mean,
five more minutes.
There was a question over here, and then I'll come back over here. Yes, sir.
Well, I just had a question. Are you saying that this is common among libertarians, with your main thesis in it, that we have a knee-jerk, or they have a knee-jerk?
Yes, they, of course, they, not I, certainly.
Very common as compared to other philosophies.
That's an excellent question.
Just as often on the other side.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, you're absolutely right.
When I tell people I'm an economist, that's like persona non grata. You tell them you're a classical free market liberal, that's the kiss of death. So no matter how nice you are beforehand, they may befriend you, they'll be nice, but as soon as you go that other, I most of the time don't tell people my philosophy unless I have, you know, a force to, or because it's just alienated. You know, so many people are involved with welfare state and the entitlement mentality and benefits. You, you start telling them these things, immediately they just forget about it.
I'm not sure that knee-jerk behavior is more common among libertarians than among other people. I mean, ideologically inclined people are going to be more inclined toward this sort of knee-jerk behavior. I mean, again, in some sense, because in some ways they're people of faith. Now, I think that our faith is much more well-grounded in reality. But there is a non-trivial component of faith in a lot of what we believe, and a lot. So I don't know if it's any worse among us. My point is, to the extent it exists among us, let's get rid of it. Let's uphold the highest intellectual standards. In fact, I have the honor of giving lectures and webinars to an organization called Students for Liberty, which, if, by the way, one of the best horses now in the race. I've always thought of Institute for Humane Studies as being arguably the best or the most important libertarian movement organization, because it helps to help bring about or helps promote understanding of libertarian ideas among young, helps promote young scholars. This organization, Students for Liberty, has only been around for about 4 years. They are doing absolutely wonderful work. I attended their international conference in D.C. About a month ago. They had 500 people from around the world. You'll have a chance to see the audience because John Stossel taped one of his programs at the conference. When I come across these young people and have the opportunity to explain ideas, I always put in a couple of boilerplate comments. And that is, we have to uphold the highest standards of intellectual integrity. The highest standards of intellectual integrity. We don't like it when people on the other side are intellectually sloppy. We have to uphold the highest standards. And that means admitting sometimes we don't know the answers. We don't know what's going to work. Also, I think we have to treat people with courtesy and respect. One, it's prudentially a good idea. But more importantly, it's just the right thing to do. And I think if we do the right thing, I happen to believe, I'm one of these people who believes basically good ideas eventually beat bad ideas. I think that the idea of society being based on liberty and responsibility is just a better idea. Societies based on the principles of liberty and personal responsibility are better societies. They are wealthier societies. And I don't mean more just in the sense of more TV sets or toaster ovens or cars. Wealthier in the sense that people can pursue their vision, their dreams, their God. The only restriction is that they cannot violate the like rights of their neighbors. Ladies and gentlemen, it is we of libertarian disposition, we're the ones who are showing real love to our neighbors, because we may disagree with them about all manner of issues about how they live their lives, but we're not going to use the big stick of the state against them unless they violate someone else's rights. We're the ones who are showing real love to our neighbors. You can live your life your way. Just don't violate the rights of your neighbors. What a truly beautiful vision we have. And I happen to believe that eventually good ideas are going to beat bad ideas. Our ideas are right. And like the old Monty Python line, I'm not only proud about that, I'm smug about it. So, I think that there are times where you will, sir, where you will, you'll have the opportunity to talk to people. They may not agree with you. That's life. Always uphold the highest standards of intellectual integrity. Treat people with courtesy and respect. And even if they come to disagree with you, they may say, doggone it, but he's at least basically a decent guy. I can respect him. May have to kill him at some point, but I can respect it. It's like the Mafia. Hey, it's not personal. So, are we? Ladies and gentlemen, again, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to see you. Okay.